After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi, everyone. This is Raghu Marcus and another edition of Ram Dass Here and Now. And I just want to prompt you all out there with a couple of things that are important to us in the podcast network. And one of them, of course, is our ongoing wonderful sponsors, 1440. And we've been talking to them for an awful long time just because what they do is so interlaced with who we are. It's quite wonderful. And to prove that point, I'm going to tell you about a wonderful weekend retreat at the end of January in our upcoming year, 2020. And it's with Sharon and Omid Safi, both of whom have wonderful podcasts on BeHereNowNetwork.com that you should check out. And this is called Path of the Courageous Heart. And if you've not been to the campus of 1440, please visit 1440.org and check it out, because it's just a beautiful campus near Santa Cruz. 1440 Multiversity. And also, we have a new supporter and somebody who I actually had a conversation with myself, who started what's called Follow Your Heart. It's a wonderful company that has a product called Veginase that I am absolutely sure that many of you know about. I have been using this egg-free mayonnaise forever, and it is Not only is it great for you, it tastes great. Okay, I use it for everything. I told them I can't even tell people enough what this means to me in terms of day to day. I don't think week to week that I've used any other food product like that as consistently. So, Follow Your Heart. This podcast is also, as we have our wonderful friends, 1440 Multiversity, this is Follow Your Heart. And I want to really, they also have a full line of dairy-free cheeses. And they're, you know, a leader in plant-based food. So go to followyourheart.com and check them out, okay? And by the way, everybody out there, of course, everything that we do under Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, ramdass.org, BeHereNowNetwork.com, and of course, our new movie that's been out this fall into the late part of the year, 2019, Becoming Nobody. So go to BecomingNobody.com and check that out as well, because I'm glad I thought of this. There will be a release in January of a DVD or download. So finally, anybody who wants to can get to see this quite wonderful film. Okay, here's the talk by Ram Dass. I want to dedicate this podcast to my good friend, Duncan Trussell. Duncan, please do listen to this podcast, and he'll know what I'm talking about, and we'll have a conversation with him on mind rolling about this, okay? Astral Fun and Games, Part 1, okay? That's the title. So this starts out with a famous, so Ram Dass starts out talking about miracles, Maharaji, Neem Karoli Baba miracles. And one famous one is Maharaji goes to, I'm not going to tell the story, but it is so out there that anybody can go, this is not possible. This can't be. But of course, those of us that were with Maharaji and were party to all of this kind of thing know that anything is possible. It's all possible with anything. So Ram Dass tells this story. Okay, now I won't get into it except that it's pretty fantastical. And he talks about, well, what's the value of a story like that? Which is kind of, you know, the inside joke with Duncan, who was like, miracles are miracles. What is the value of it? Is it titillation? Or is it just because it's converting the skeptic? And when we get lost, you know, in life, and we are completely without any recompense whatsoever, that there is a way to get out of this mess. Yeah, a miracle might appear. You know, and it happens to people, Maharaji's one example because that's who we know. And he is, not a was, it's an is, as many people experience him in that same body with that same blanket, not the ones like us that saw him back in the day, but certainly people that are connected in the same way that we are with this being, which is in itself miraculous, absolutely see him many, many times. I see this all the time. We just did a retreat and I talked about this directly with Lama Surya Das. He seems to be making lots of appearances to people. So the body, not body, you don't need a body, you don't need a guru in a body, all of it is like, you know, who really knows what's going on? But miracles touch, Ram Dass says, miracles touch you and, you know, touch you in a way that's beyond mine. And they start an opening and it's trust, and that becomes a little bit of faith. And it really works even more because many people can do, you know, that have powers, can they're not necessarily realized beings, or what we call in India, or what we were told, these kind of beings like Neem Karoli Baba are siddhas, that they're not living any subject object, yet they're relating in a human body. So it's an unusual state. But the more pure the being is that actually does these miracles. And as I said, many beings can do it. They don't necessarily, the powers are available to beings, as pretty much we all know, because we see it in our world, social interactions that we have, political. There are people who have powers, you know, the power of a silver tongue. So, but the more pure that a being is, then the more effect this has to open up our more, call it our spiritual natures. Miracles are exquisite because your mind gets undercut. There's no rational way to explain them. So it's very purposeful that this all happened to us in particular with Ram Dass. There's a great story, by the way, here of Ram Dass with Mayor Baba. It's a very famous story related to the psychedelics that Mayor Baba told Ram Dass it was okay to take in a letter three times, but that was it. But then they got really uptight. He got uptight. There was a whole scene around psychedelics with Mayor Baba who basically told him that you keep doing it and you just get addicted to the experience, which when Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass, gave him acid, he basically came down to pretty much the same thing. You know, you see Christ, you're able to be with Christ for a couple of hours. It's not true samadhi. You have to come down. Better to become Christ, but it could be useful, and which is the same as you're just going to get addicted to the experience. So some great stuff around Ram Dass's experience with Mayor Baba. Somebody called it that the psychedelic trip has an astral, maybe this is Mayor Baba, astral analogy of reality. How about that? An astral analogy of reality. So, but all of it is more dualism, and Ram Dass talks about that. And how do you go beyond dualism? How do you transform your own separateness into become merely a statement of the Dharma or a statement of God? Or a statement of the way things are. And it ends with him. And there's some great stuff around Krishnamurti, everybody, which is really cool. And he ends, a free being is not bound by a plane of consciousness whatsoever. So it's all about give up clinging. We got to do it. That's it. Here it is. Here's Ram Dass. And it's just part one. It's great. I mean, this is a big deal. You know, people get, as Ram Dass said, after a while, after he came back to America from the first time in India, he said it was the power, the miracles that blew him away. And then he realized that what was really happening was the unconditional love. Yeah, and that's basically all of our experiences. But today, you know, there's still all these miraculous things going on, particularly with Neem Karoli Baba, with people who are just finding him. And I guess I see the downfall of getting caught. And I remember when it happened to me, I wanted more. You know, there's no ending of that. And it just becomes another desire. But it's still, there's still a shining light that is needed to break up darkness, which is what a guru does. So I see it as just part of that unconditional love. All right, well, that's it. Here you go. Astral fun and games. This is Ram Dass. I don't even know when this is. They didn't tell me. But we'll see you next week on, the Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And there are so many wonderful podcasts that are happening. Check out David Nickturn, by the way. He has this great new book. And he's been doing podcasts. He just did one that's out with Rodney Yee and his wife. So check that out. And we'll catch you next time. Ram Dass, Here and Now.
There is a story about Maharaji in his earlier years, which he was a wandering sadhu, holy man, and he was in a small village in India. And he was in a barber shop or at a barber's. Barbers usually squat by the side of the road, and you just squat down next to them, and they shave you, and for about 2 pennies or something like that. And he was being shaved by this barber, and the barber was spending the whole time. Barbers are usually very talkative fellows, and he was spending all the time complaining about the horrible plight because his son had left him some years before, and he had lost contact, and he knew he'd die soon, and he just yearned to see his son. And he was a very, very pure man, the barber. And he kept talking about this and talking about this. And he had slathered up Maharaji's face. And he had shaved about half of it. And finally, Maharaji just threw off the cover and jumped up and ran down the street. And the next day, late in the afternoon. The barber's son arrived. And the barber was overjoyed, and he said, what are you doing here? And the son says, well, I don't really understand what happened. He said, I'm the manager in a hotel. Now, it's about 200 miles from here. And he said, yesterday, at around 10 in the morning, which is just when Maharaji was at the barber's, he said, I was standing behind the desk at the hotel, and this man ran into the hotel, and he was half-shaven. He had soap all over one side of his face, and he said, quick, quick, your father needs you. Go home immediately. And he handed me a railway ticket, and he ran out again. Now, just take that story for what it is, right? What's the value of a story like that? What use? Does it just titillate our fascination with the potential powers of human beings? There is a very high yogi in India named Sai Baba, who manifests things, usually small things. The most frequent thing he manifests is vibhuti, or sacred ash. And you can go and see him do it right now. You could go and get on a plane now. There's miracles that are right there available for the skeptic. You can go to India, to Delhi, and then go south, and or Bombay, and then go to Puttaparthi or Whitehall. And there, twice a day, usually, there are long lines on one side of the women and on the other side the men. And Sai Baba comes out, and he's a radiantly beautiful being. And he starts to walk down the lines, and he's wearing a long saffron-colored robe with his sleeves, either short sleeves or his sleeves rolled up. And every now and then he looks at somebody, and he stops, and he motions, and the man behind him hands him a little piece of paper, maybe usually a piece of torn up newspaper, and sticks it on his hand. And Sai Baba goes like this, and right from above his hand, this ash appears out of the akash, out of the nowhere, and falls on the paper, and he wraps it up, and he says, here, take some of this for your dysentery, or something like that, and then he walks on, okay? And now and then he goes like that, and a bracelet, or a necklace, or a some kind of a pendant or something appears. When I was with him, I introduced Muktananda to him. I brought, I was the shutkin arranging that really strange marriage. And that evening, or the evening before, when I was out there arranging it, he invited me to come to the singing of kirtan, bhajan singh. And I sat in the back, and he motioned me to come up and sit in front. He sat in a chair, and I sat at his feet down here. And he put me through the third degree. I'm sort of fair game for everyone, you know, to sort of show where I'm not. So he asked me what God was. Whatever I answered was wrong, of course. It's one of those impossible questions, which I was just the foil for him to give a lecture, really. But afterwards, he rewarded me. As he was leaving, he said, would you like something? And I said, no, Babaji, I don't want anything. I just much joy in just being with you. He says, no, let me give you something. And he was sitting in front of me, and his hand was about where, right here in relation to my face, all right? And he started to go like this, and I knew he was going to do one of those things, you see, which I hadn't yet seen him do, I sort of from a distance. And there's the scientist in me, you know, that said, now I'm not going to blink, and I'm not going to be suggestible, and I'm going to watch his other hand, and I'm going to stay perfectly conscious, because I have to report back. I mean, I have a responsibility here to my skeptical colleagues. So I watched, but it did it for me, because first there was this kind of shimmery blue light that appeared on his hand. And then slowly it solidified and it took form. And it was this little medallion, which was made of aluminum, perhaps. It was a circle with a five-pointed star in it, on which there was a gold-plated image of Sai Baba. Right. It was the kind of thing you might buy in Tijuana for about 8 cents. And he handed it to me, and it wasn't even warm. I mean, you didn't get a feeling. It had just come from another plane or anything. It was, there was a humor in the whole thing, that here was this incredible power being used to give something that you would look at and throw away, generally. I mean, you'd say, isn't that nice? It's the kind of thing you could buy outside the temple at the stands there, and they're made by Indian workmen, you know, and they're really schlock articles. And that's humor. I mean, it's so much more humorous than were he to give you some precious jewel that never appeared on this plane at all ever before, you know. It's really, in the sense, he's showing you that the miracles are a throwaway. And he gives watches to people that say made in Switzerland and stuff like that, right? Which feeds everybody's doubt. Like, what is he doing? I mean, is he just so good a magician that you can't see? And when I hung around there, one old Swami said to me, you know, he said, he doesn't make those things. I said, oh, no, I understand. He says, no, he just moves them with his mind from his warehouse. I said, is that all he does? You know, it's like... And I had an image of that warehouse, you know, with 600 watches and stacks and big bins of Vibhuti, and slowly they're disappearing down and watches are disappearing off the shelves. It must be an extraordinary scene to just... He just takes matter and he dematerializes it, moves it in space, and rematerializes it with his mind. And Christ said, had ye but faith, he could move mountains. I mean, so there's nothing to moving, you know, a little thing with his image on. One of my favorite miracle stories is the Nityananda story. I've told it many times, but I love it so much because it's this humor, such humor. I love humor in this game because it's tends to be so serious, and it's really so funny. Nityananda used to, he was Muktananda's guru. I mean, he had considerable claim to fame independent of being Muktananda's guru, but he was one of the really great, great saints of India. And he used to have workmen build roads around to the little villages that had no roads to sort of increase their economic efficiency and so on. And the workmen were paid about 2 rupees, maybe 30 cents, 35 cents a day, which was the going wage. And Nityananda would say, at the end of the day, when you finish working, you don't have to come to the paymaster and all. You just go home. And on the way home, any rock you see that you feel like, you pick up that rock, and under the rock will be your 2 rupees. And so they'd finish their work, and they'd go home, and they'd, on the way home, they'd lift a rock, and there would be their 2 rupees. And, you know, you couldn't lift 2 rocks and get 4 rupees. It was just one rock, one set of two, one, just 2 rupees. One 2 rupee note. Well, the problem was all the rupee notes were brand new notes. And after a while, the police started to get curious about this phenomenon because the rumor was spreading. And so the inspector came, and with his sergeant, and he said, Babaji, I'm terribly sorry to bother you, but we're a little embarrassed about this, but there are all these new rupee notes around, and we just don't know where they're being produced. And Nityananda says, oh, I understand your predicament perfectly. He said, come, I'll show you. Let me take you to the place where they're being produced. So he took the inspector and the sergeant. And you've got to understand the picture completely, really. Just, you don't have to, but the fun of it. In India, the bureaucracy, what they did, the Indian people did, was when the English came in, they came in with this exquisite bureaucracy. And the Indians imitated it incredibly. And the whole thing is like an imitative game. And they're very, very bureaucratic with great sense of duty about it, right? And a great sense of purity and righteousness about it. So they were with their notebooks and all ready to collect the data. And he took them off into the jungle. He's a great big fat fellow lumbering through the jungle. They were following him behind. He went deeper and deeper into the jungle till he came to a lake. And in southern India, some of the lakes have alligators in them. And this one had alligators. And he walked into the water and he called the alligator. And this big alligator came over. And he took the alligator and he opened his mouth. And he reached in and he started pulling rupee notes out of his throat, you see. And that took care of the inspector and the sergeant, who went running off down the path, never to bother him again. Right? There's this funny level in India, you see, because there's the government and the army, which is doing its thing. Then there are these saints and gurus who are making a shambles of the whole thing. But in a kind of a random and bizarre way, so that when, for example, India was having trouble with China, all the vice presidents and presidents of India ran to their gurus to get covered, right? And it's that level, and yet you never know whether they did it or didn't do it. The whole thing is covered with dust and confusion and doubt. Are they all charlatans? Is it real? Maharaji had a way of doing these gross miracles and then denying it, just outright, blatantly denying it after he'd just done it. There's a big outing like this in which everybody's going to eat lunch afterwards, and they've gone miles to get to the place, and they forgot to bring the ghee, the clarified butter, to cook the puris in and so on. And everybody's freaked because they've come miles and they can't possibly get back to get it. And Maharaji goes out into the woods to pee, and he comes back screaming, raging, yelling, "People are so irresponsible. Do you know people left out there tins and tins of ghee just sitting out in the woods?" And, you know, he was just screaming with indignation. And there's no way you can say to him now, "Look, Maharaji, you know that ghee isn't out there." Well, what is the value of all of these astral fun and games? Probably for beings at different stages of evolution, the value is different. That at the stage where you are lost in Maya or illusion or the dance of life, and there is no awakening in sight, these miracles tend to touch you in a certain way, in the way that the miracles that Christ performed touch the people around them, around him. And they start a process. They start an opening, a faith. What happens in India, they often become a worship of the person that does the power, which is a complete misconception of what the game is about. But it's in the right direction, especially if the being is a pure being. Right? For people who are more ready to awaken but are caught in their intellects, like most Westerners, the miracles are exquisite because they up-level your intellect, because you can't explain it with your mind. It just won't work. There's no rational system for explaining what happens in these miracles. And in that sense, it blows your mind, or it undercuts it. That's what Maharaji did to me the first time. He blew my mind. There was no way he could know what he knew. And it was as if I ran through all my paranoia and there was nowhere to hang it. I couldn't grab. There wasn't any way I could explain how I was being had or conned. And that started to open me in a certain way. What these fit into very nicely is into the path that is called devotional or bhakti yoga. you appreciate that we are meeting here, as I said before, on the physical plane. And then when you dream, you're on another plane. And there are literally planes and planes and planes of consciousness. Or lokas. There means planes of existence. And there are beings on these planes, on many of them. Some there aren't, but most there are. And these planes go and they change in their vibratory rate. They're like television channels. So that when you tune to one, you may not be tuned to another. You may flip from channel to channel. As you get higher on these planes into higher vibratory rates where there's more space and more light, fewer beings exist in these planes. And these beings are much clearer, wiser, higher, less attached. They have less desires that keep pulling them into these other planes. And in the highest plane called the Siddhaloka, in which there are beings who are light bodies. They're not in these forms. They're merely lights, if you will. They're light consciousness. And they are really, at that moment, aware of the fact that they're all the same thing. They are all just still separate, but the same. It's that level of existence on that plane. Yesterday, when we went around the room and said, "What have you got?" a lot of you said purple, gold. These are all colors attached to various planes. Purple plane up in here, for example. When you connect with a plane up through your third eye, you may experience a purple plane. You learn how to go in and out of all of these planes, colors. Each one has a sound connected with it. You'll hear the sound of flutes, the sound of bells, the sound of rivers rushing, a crowd in a railway station, bees buzzing. There are all these different kinds of, these are just saying what they sound like, of course. There are what are called the masters, Master Mourier and Kutumi and set of masters who are beings that live on intermediate planes. They'd be called high astral planes that are in a way involved with this physical plane. That is, there is some commerce across planes. Each of the planes, this plane seems, because of the heaviness of the illusion, this plane seems very horizontal. That is, everybody on this plane seems to be involved with everybody else on this plane, and very rarely are there connections made across these planes. And then every now and then, somebody, when they leave their body, when they die, they send messages back. And there are a lot of books written by people who've sent messages back telling what it's like on the other planes. And there is a certain beauty and poignancy and humor in all of this also, because just because a being is on another plane doesn't mean that they're any higher than you are. And what often happens is that these beings send back very well-meaning descriptions of what it's like on the other plane, and it's merely like they went from Rhode Island to Boston. Right? And they're sending back long descriptions of Boston, and everybody's assuming out there is Boston, which is just another place, right? But they don't know that, because just like you don't know it most of the time, right? And they think, well, I went across and I got to the other place, right? Like there was a fellow who was a television medium, Arthur Ford, and he died a few years back, and he wrote a book through a woman in Washington. I remember what her name was. Huh? Ruth Montgomery, yeah. He dictated it through. She just sat at the typewriter and he took over her consciousness and dictated the book. And the book describes what his life is like. Right? And obviously what's happened is he's gone to a reasonably low astral plane and he's being trained now for further incarnations and work. And he's in a place where he goes to school, you know, and it's just, it sounds kind of humdrum, you know. But if you if you read the like Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, that you get some very subtle and beautiful descriptions of some of the planes where the planes are made totally of light. And you create any form you want for your body or anything around you just with thought, which is actually what we're doing, but we don't know we're doing it, so it doesn't pay to talk about it here. But there, it's very obvious. You can create huge radishes or purple radishes with, you know, with stars pouring out of them and stuff like that. And it's like a total costume party all the time, because everybody's creating whatever body they wanted, so that if somebody dies and goes to that plane, and they may have died at 90 years old and their body was very infirm, but they may take a body on that plane that is like the body they always wanted to have, or they had at the prime, or whenever they wanted it. And so when you meet beings who have, quote, passed over, you often meet these beings who were, you almost don't recognize because you're so busy remembering them like you last saw them, and that just isn't where they're at anymore. Now, in terms of your work, and we're, as you recall, we decided that the scenario of this gathering was that you want liberation. You want God, you want to be free. It would be hardly free if you were merely moved from this plane to that plane. You would be just as entrapped in that plane as you are in this plane. And that's why you've got to understand the way in which these planes are related to desire systems. For example, if you want power, you will get power. There are planes in which you will have all the powers to create all the miracles. If you are righteous, you will go to places where everybody is righteous. It's called heaven. It's all good. Right? It's not liberation, but it's nice. In fact, any loka or any plane at all that can be defined is just another place, no matter how exquisite it is. Now, this is very, very subtle stuff, extremely subtle, to appreciate this one. Perhaps it can be done a little bit through an understanding of what are called the jhanas in Buddhism, in the Tripitaka, which is the Buddhist Pali text. They describe how as you your mind gets clearer and stronger and more laser-like, you go into, you can go a path that goes through what are called the eight jhanas, which are like trance states. And these states involve incredible rapture, and they involve incredible bliss, and they involve incredible beauty. But the last four of them are really far out. They involve, for example, the feeling of omniscience. They involve the feeling of being the one in the entire universe. They involve the feeling of emptiness. But notice the way I'm saying it. They involve the feeling of universality, the feeling of oneness. They are experiences of oneness. That is different from the one, if you can understand what I'm talking about. In other words, no matter how high these jhanas get, they are all still in dualism. That is, there is an experiencer, and there is that which is experienced. There is a subject-object separation. And many, many very high beings get lost. They experience themselves as being omnipotent and universal, and they conclude that they are enlightened, when actually they have merely entered through a samadhi state into a very high trance in which they have experienced omniscience and universality, but they are not omniscient or universal necessarily. Okay? They may have great powers. Great, great powers. But it's like the penultimate ego trip, if you can hear it. It's the ultimate expansion of ego It's not the death of the ego. It's the pushing of the ego out to its outer bounds. And that's all short of what the Arahant goes through, or the stream enterers and stream makers and the Buddha and the Tathagata and all the beings who have finished, who have gone beyond self, who have died, if you will, into thy will, not my will. And that's a big distinction. That goes beyond dualism at that point. And I think many people have gotten sucked in by that. For example, when I used to take LSD all the time, I would experience feelings of great powers, great wisdom. I could know what was happening in other places. I could read other people's minds. There were moments when I spoke in tongues. There were moments when I spoke poetically. There were all these great powers poured through me. And I could create the universe with my mind any way I wanted it to be. I obviously had the power to control other people's minds. But I would always come down from these. And I think that what I was trying to do for many years was to not come down from them, so I would have all these powers. That was all ego. I didn't fully understand it, even though Meher Baba and I had carried on a correspondence back in 1964, in which what had happened was that the commune I was living in Los Altos, California, some of the people there were followers of Meher Baba, and some of them were me and the gal I was with and her baby, and they were all druggies, psychedelic explorers. And Meher Baba sent a message back saying, my devotee should have nothing to do with anybody that's using drugs. And that upset us because we were going to have to break up the community. So I wrote a letter to Meher Baba, and I said, Meher Baba, it's funny to write to God, you know, and I said, dear Meher Baba, I know you appreciate this, but none of us in America would have ever come to, or most of us in America would never have come to appreciating your books were it not for psychedelics. And it's a little bit like biting the hand that feeds you. I didn't put it quite that way, but like I came to love you and honor you through psychedelics, and could it all be bad if in the sense I only understand your words through you? And I got a telegram immediately. I know you're a true lover. Don't worry. Be happy. And a letter will follow. And a letter followed. And the letter said, a few serious seekers like you can use this medicine. You may take it three more times and then you should stop. But other people shouldn't use it. And it will drive them insane. And it is no more like the true reality than a mirage is like water. And to continue to use it will drive you insane because you will get addicted to the experience. Now, at the time, I was very emotionally involved in using LSD, and I didn't want to hear this at all. And the Meher Baba people watched to see what I would do, and we all counted off one, two, three. And then came the Berkeley Conference on LSD in 1966, I guess. I made a point of taking LSD for the fourth time just before that conference. And that led the Meher Baba people to picket the conference. And it was a whole melodrama that unfolded. And then Meher Baba said terrible things about me. And I said terrible things about Meher Baba. And I still loved him. But that was why it was funny when I got to Maharaji. And the first thing he said is, Meher Baba is your guru. You know, that was like... So after Maharaji took LSD for the second time in 1970, and this time he had taken 1,200 micrograms, and I watched him put them in his mouth, so I knew that he had taken them, which I had doubted from the time before, and nothing happened to him. He then said, this is yogi medicine. He said it was known about long ago in the Kulu Valley by yogis, but it's all been forgotten now. He said it's useful, that it would allow you to come in and be in the presence of Christ. You could have his darshan, pranam to him. You could even stay for 2 hours. But then you'd have to leave again. Say, it's not the true samadhi. But he said it would be better to become Christ than to just visit with him. But LSD won't do that for you. This yogi medicine won't do that for you. He said, but if you're in a cool place and you're feeling much peace and your mind is turned totally towards God, it could be useful. But it's not the true samadhi. See, because even visiting a saint is useful, he said, as we sat at his feet. Now I was ready to hear what he was saying, what Meher Baba had said also, that what these chemicals were doing were taking me into the jhanas or into astral analogs of reality, but they weren't the thing itself. They were still the experience of it, the separation, the one level away. They were still in dualism. I had not transcended dualism yet. I had not become it. And that's why I kept coming down from it, because I wasn't in it. And it's roughly the same issue with all of this, the astral goodies. They are all ultimately more dualism. However, since you are beings who seek liberation, and therefore you must seek to go beyond dualism, the question is, in view of your karmic predicament, how do you get beyond dualism? That is, how do you kill yourself without killing yourself? How do you transform your own separateness into becoming merely a statement of the Dharma or a statement of God? How do you do that? Now, the most extreme method of doing that is reflected in people like Krishnamurti or Zen Buddhism or the Song of Mahamudra, the Vow of Mahamudra, which says, in effect, you already are the Buddha nature. Stop screwing around. Just be who you are. Don't use methods. Don't get caught in dualism. Don't do anything. Just be free. Forget it. Stop thinking you're somebody and just be it. That's known as the steep path with no guardrail. Because in that sense, you just go in and you sit down in the Zen, the Zenery, the Zen, Zendo. Thank you. You go and you sit down in the Zendo. And you just sit. And then you say, well, what do I do? Well, that's a Western thought. What do I do? Just sit. They don't even tell you to follow your breath. That's already schlock Zen. I mean, that's already sneaking in Southern Buddhism. I mean, the real Zen purists, just sit. Should I close my eyes? Just sit. Well, what do I think about? Just sit. You are the Buddha. You're enlightened. What's all the production about? Just sit. Just be. Be who you are. And you scream because you got to struggle with, well, what do I do? See, I mean, like, we're giving you things to do. I mean, every second you got something to do. This is very different from a Zen sesshin. Even the koans are not pure in that sense of that form of Zen. They are the weaker form, if you will, because they're using the mind to beat the mind, which is jnana yoga. That's not the ultimate. Take it. By all means, take it. Don't get screwed up with gurus, with meditation practices, with singing to nonsensical beings, with moving your body and standing on your head. What a bunch of nonsense. I mean, why get lost in all that junk? Why don't you just become enlightened? Okay. I mean, I'm giving you the straight, clean Krishnamurti Zen line now. Okay. Of course, Krishnamurti is very funny. We'll talk about it later, but because of his history, I'll save that for later. It's such fun. Well, no, because it fits in here. Krishnamurti was a young boy, an Indian boy, who was picked up off the street by, is it Annie Besant or Madame Blavatsky? I guess it was Annie Besant. Annie Besant and Colonel Olcott. Colonel Olcott. They were the heads of the Theosophical Society, and they were looking to found a new religion, and they needed a new world leader. And there was this beautiful young boy who had obviously very high astral stuff, and they could see, they had third eyes were open, and they saw he was a very high being. And they said, this is the one. And they took him, and they groomed him, and they trained him, and he became the head of the Order of the Star, I guess it was called. And there were at one time 70,000 members of it. And he wrote beautiful things, and he had great visions, and he went into trances, and he used to sit under trees and go into samadhi, and all of the stuff just the way that trip is supposed to go down. And then around in his 20s, he repudiated the whole thing. He disbanded the order, said the whole thing's a hype, it's just a trap, it's keeping you from God, I won't be a party to this absurdity. And he stayed very close to the Theosophists, some of them, in which there was a lot of infighting. But he then went off to become a very great statement of don't use any methods because they're all traps. However, his method or his way of becoming to where he got to involved all those experiences. So there is a little bit of peculiarity in his telling everybody else not to do it when he himself came through it. It's like me saying to you, don't use drugs. I can't in true conscience say that to you because I am very beholden to psychedelics for the way in which they change my consciousness. And I'm not about to knock them, no matter who tells me how moral I'm supposed to be about it. Right? Okay. Well, for most of you, my telling you you are Buddha and there's no reason to do any methods didn't enlighten you immediately. If it did, you're being very cool about it. That's all energy. All free energy. See, if you take it and don't get caught in the symbolic nature of it, just take it as energy and feed it up your spine. Get incredibly high on it. Thank you. Since most of us can't go the steepest path, because of the clingings of our heart or our mind, we start to use a stepladder. And the stepladder involves all the practices we do. And the stepladder can involve all these planes of consciousness. That is, you can use one plane in order to liberate you from another plane. Just in the same way, if you grew up as I did, going through psychology graduate school, so that your instruments of individual differences were the Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory and the California personality inventory and the Rorschach inkblot test and the etc., the Leary interpersonal checklist and so on. If that was your mosaic of individual differences, and then you meet a good astrologer, you suddenly get a whole new fix of individual differences that up-levels the game you were stuck in terms of individual differences in personality. Do you understand that? That's just like another plane of reality of individual differences still. And you say, oh, well, all of her body symptoms and all of her personality is explained by the fact that she's a Taurus and her moon is in the ascendant on the 12th house under on Thursday or whatever, however that's done, right? And actually, the higher up you get on the game, the better your predictive power. So a good astrologer, which is what they have in India, which is somebody who is an astrologer coming out of a higher plane rather than the way we do it. We read a book on astrology and climb up and grab at a few individual difference matrices and then become professionals. But there are beings who are wise men and women who are then astrologers. They merely come down into form as astrologer. And their astrological insights of individual differences are exquisitely high in terms. I mean, they beat the predictability of any science we have, any social science we have in the West. But I'm talking about the wise men astrologers, not the book learning astrologers. Okay. These are astrologers who use both the birth and the conception sign and the sun sign. They use all the signs all at once rather than any one of them. so that you can use another plane. Because if you start to, if you sit down and meditate and suddenly you come up and you experience yourself as this this old yogini sitting in a mountain cave, and you feel the reality of that, and then you come back into this plane, the sense of another identity in you changes the meaning of this identity. It loosens the hold of it a little bit. And the game is that you use these other planes to loosen the hold of the physical plane. The problem is, or the difficulty or the delicacy of it is, that most of these planes have more energy connected with them, more shakti, more power, more light, more intensity than this plane does. And they are very seductive, and you'd rather stay there than here, unless they are very ugly planes, hell lokas. And when somebody stays on one of those planes and then doesn't come back to this plane, in this culture, we call them psychotic. In other cultures, they treat them differently. For example, Meher Baba spent much time going around India taking care of what are called the musts. These are God intoxicants. They're beings who have gone into other planes and they aren't back here, and we would hospitalize them. But in India, many of them are treated as great saints because when you're around them, you can feel the incredible light force and energy, and they are seeing often much more clearly than we're seeing, but they aren't able to keep it together on this plane. And they can't eat and they can't wash themselves, and Meher Baba would take care of them. He'd wash them and feed them and so on. Now, all people that are stuck on other planes aren't necessarily high saints, because you've got to understand what sticks you on these planes. What sticks you are your attachments, your clingings, your desires. So if you want power, you could go to a plane in which there's great power and you'd want to stick there because you are very, very power hungry. That doesn't make you necessarily very spiritual. But there are beings that go to other planes, and because the plane is closer to God, they're just pulled towards God. The pull is incredible and they don't want to come back. A good guide in the work of inner planes, whatever plane you'll get to, just like I was telling you in the meditations yesterday, the day before, whatever you get into, notice it, acknowledge it, allow it, don't judge it, don't push it away, then take another breath and go on. In other words, don't cling to whatever plane of reality you're in, including this one. Because a free being is not bound by any plane of reality whatsoever. None whatsoever.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at Ramdas.org. We can then continue to share what Ram Dass has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.